This nation was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That all men are created equal.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear. I mean, really, no fear.
Created equal.
Welcome to Created Equal. I'm Stephen Henderson at WDET in Detroit. War creates vulnerable people by destroying infrastructure and institutions, by damaging culture and tradition. And those vulnerabilities don't end when the fighting does. They linger, and in some cases, they shape lives forever. Imagine what that means if you're pregnant and living in a war zone. If the birth of your child might take place between bombings, without doctors, or without the medical support to keep you and your baby safe. Two reporters for the podcast Reveal have chronicled the story of a Palestinian woman who lived that nightmare. We've all heard the political takes on the war that Israel is waging, ostensibly against the terrorist group Hamas, but increasingly devastating for ordinary Palestinians in Gaza. But how much time have we really spent hearing about the toll, the true toll, on the people who are made vulnerable by that war? Normally, we open the show with a conversation between me and the show's producer, Carey Jr. II. But we're not doing that today, in part because this is really the first time we've addressed this subject of the war that's going on in Gaza. It's a sensitive subject and one that brings really emotional reactions, I find, when you talk to people about it. We've chosen to start the discussion about it here in this way, deliberately, specifically, focused on the people of Gaza and what they're experiencing. I think that's really important, no matter what your political take is on what's happening there. The people in that region are suffering. They're suffering in ways that most of us could never imagine suffering in our own lives. And I think we can only really understand what's happening in the region and what it means by hearing those stories. Today, we'll hear from Salman Ahmad Khan and Gabrielle Berbet about their reporting on Lubna, a Palestinian mother who found herself pregnant and in need of intensive medical care just as the war in Gaza began to ramp up. Gabrielle and Salman, welcome to Created Equal.
Thanks so much for having us.
So I want to start with Lubna and Wafa, the main women you follow for this story. Tell our listeners who they are and how you came across their stories.
Well, I'll start with Lubna. We connected with Lubna in mid-November. She is from Gaza City. When we connected with her, she was in Khan Yunis. She had been evacuated from her home in Gaza City. But Lubna is 42 years old. She is from Gaza City, was born there. She has two teenage daughters, and she's the head of the elementary school at the American International School in Gaza, which is a pretty prestigious school. Mm-hmm. And we connected with her because she was pregnant. In mid-November, she was 7 months pregnant with a surprise pregnancy because her daughters were teenagers. She actually had a gender reveal party just 2 weeks before October 7th. And we connected with her because we wanted to understand what it meant to plan for a delivery in Gaza at that moment, mm-hmm. While the medical system and all of Gaza was under siege. So that was kind of the like driving question that we had when we connected with her. She because she's 42 years old, she had a high-risk pregnancy, and she also was going to need a C-section because she had C-sections with her two daughters. So that was the biggest question that she had when we connected with her, was how am I going to plan for my C-section right now in this moment?
Yeah, yeah. And Salman, tell us a little about Wafa, her sister.
Yeah, so Wafa, we were mostly focusing our story on Lubna, but at some point in our reporting process, we actually lost touch with Lubna because the internet connection was so bad and she had just been evacuated to Rafah and she was living in a refugee camp. So there was a point during our reporting process where we just kept reaching out to Lubna and we didn't know what had happened to her. We didn't know if she was alive, if she was safe, if she had delivered. But at the same time, we did know that she had talked about a family member, family members in Canada. She had sisters in Canada. And we had also been doing some reporting on another story at the same time where we were reporting on Palestinian Canadians who were trying to get their family members out.
Mm-hmm.
And so through that reporting process, we had actually found a WhatsApp group of Gazan Canadians who had actually been lobbying the Canadian government. And they had created this group to kind of basically organize with each other as a grassroots movement and to lobby their ministers, to lobby the government, to get their family members out. So we reached out to that group and we thought if we can't get in touch with Lubna, we should try to find her sister and see what actually happened to her. So we reached out to this group and one person connected us to another. And then eventually somebody said, oh, I know Lubna's brother. Let me talk to him. And then eventually they connected us all, they connected us to Lubna's sister, Wafa. When we reached out to Wafa, we had thought that she was in Canada this whole time. But then during our very first call, she just immediately told us she was actually just in Gaza. She had been in Gaza till November, actually. And she had gotten evacuated because she was a Canadian citizen, but Lubna was not. So she had to make the really difficult decision to leave her family behind at the border and basically evacuate with her kids.
Wow.
When she evacuated, she immediately started reaching out to Canadian government officials, trying to convince them to get her sister out. But at the time, Canada's policy didn't recognize siblings as part of your immediate family. They didn't recognize your siblings or your parents as part of your immediate family.
Mm.
And so I think my understanding is it was mostly limited to spouses or common law partners and children. And so Wafa started to email the Canadian government and she started lobbying them to get her pregnant sister out because she knew that, Lubna was 42 years old. She needed a C-section and hospitals all around Gaza had run out of C-sections because of Israel's blockade.
Yeah.
Had run out of anesthesia. Sorry. Because of Israel's blockade. And so she was really concerned about her sister's health, but she didn't really get much support from the Canadian government side. And so we started following her as she tried to lobby the government to petition them, to email them, to try to do anything she can to get her sister out.
We've got a few clips here from your episode of the Reveal podcast. Here, Wafa is describing how the war upends everyday life for people in Gaza.
It's like, imagine that you're living a regular day, right? Okay, you wake up. You took your kids to school, right? School is destroyed. You'll go to the gym, okay? In the morning, gym was destroyed. You'll go to get groceries, destroyed. Go back to my house, destroyed. Everything is destroyed. Every single thing. There's nothing left. You know what I'm telling you? When I tell you there's nothing left, there's nothing left.
So I want to talk a little about what the conditions were like in Gaza and in other parts of Palestine before the war started. I think, you know, everyone has now seen the destruction and the devastation that the war has brought to Palestine and Gaza. But I'm not sure everyone really understands what kind of place it was before. So let's talk about what the chances might have been that Lubna could get you know, decent health care during her pregnancy in Gaza before what we've seen happen in the last few months.
Yeah, I think despite the long blockade on Gaza, the medical infrastructure there was still fairly developed. Doctors there had a lot of, like, doctors there had the training and skills to deliver, do major operations, and they had been, like, before the war, this wouldn't have been a difficult pregnancy. I mean, obviously it would have been difficult because Lubna is 42, mm-hmm. But as far as the medical system and the type of care that she needed at this age, she would have been able to get that care before October 7th.
So Wafa talks about the destruction she experienced, which led to her fleeing. This idea of what the war does to the medical system in Gaza is really important. Let's talk about what Lubna's options might have looked like. What, given that, as you pointed out before, they'd run out of anesthesia, for instance. What choices did she face, Gabrielle, before she delivered?
So I think it depends on where you are in her pregnancy. So when we connected with her, she was in Khan Yunis.
Mm-hmm.
In Khan Yunis at that point, the hospital, the largest hospital there that she was likely going to go to was Nasser Hospital. And the problem with Nasser Hospital at that point in mid-November is that it was already running out of fuel and water. So Lubna is obviously concerned about anesthesia, but she's also very concerned about in Nasser Hospital, if she delivers her baby early and that baby needs an incubator, will that baby have an incubator? If she, if she goes to the hospital for a checkup, will she contract an infection in the hospital? Mm-hmm. At that point, hospitals were, and still are, extremely unsanitary because there's no, like cleaning supplies, cleaning protocols. There's barely any, like, medical supplies. So her options were very limited. You know, UNFPA, which is the UN's reproductive rights arm, they had already been distributing, by mid-November, already been distributing these delivery kits into Gaza. Mm-hmm. And the kits had soap, a plastic bag, a plastic sheet to deliver on, scissors for cutting the umbilical cord, umbilical tape, and a pamphlet instructing women how to deliver their own babies. But the problem is that none of that was actually going to be helpful for Lubna because she needed a C-section.
Right.
So really her option was, I have to get out. And that was the most realistic option for her at that point.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think...
Go ahead.
Just to jump in, I think it was also really hard for her to even go to a hospital because not just because the hospitals were overwhelmed, but it was really hard to even get to the hospital because hospitals and their surrounding areas were also being bombed.
Mm-hmm.
And so Lubna was telling us a story where her daughter had a stomach bug because they just didn't have access to clean water. And it was getting so bad that they needed medical care. So her husband took her daughter to the hospital. And then while they were on their way to the hospital, there was an Israeli airstrike nearby. And there was just a flood of injured and dead bodies that were coming into the hospital at the same time. And her husband basically had to hug their daughter to basically shield her eyes from all the bloodshed. And all she really needed was some simple medication for a stomach bug. And even for that simple medication, they basically had to go through all of that. And so when they came back and told Lubna, I think it just made it even harder for her to imagine how she in her pregnant state will actually be able to visit any doctor.
Yeah. Here's a clip of Lubna sharing her feelings about being pregnant during this time.
It's like a nightmare. All the time, heck, I'm thinking about it, especially that I have to deliver my baby by C-section.
Lubna is due in 8 weeks, and her delivery feels like a time bomb.
I feel depressed. I feel down, really. This is not the life we used to have.
So I want to talk a little about Lubna's emotional state when you connect with her. I mean, I think for anybody who's ever had a child, anyone who's ever been involved with the birth of a child, this story is just harrowing. I mean, there is enough stress and anxiety related to, creating a new life in any circumstances, in the best of circumstances. Here she finds herself in maybe the worst. Talk about how she was feeling about all of this and their chances.
So when we asked her what her delivery plan was in mid-November, she was feeling so hopeless because she did not have one. I mean, her plan, again, was to get out. At the same time, there was also this denial that the war would continue. She just kept saying, I just want to go back to Gaza City. I mean, at that point, Gaza City was already, completely under attack. And she didn't even know if her house was standing, but she just kept saying, I just want to go back to Gaza City. I just want this war to be over. I just want to deliver in Gaza City.
I'm very related to my city. You know, I love my city, Gaza. And I don't like to leave my family. Why to leave my family? Mm-hmm. And why to leave my city? Mm-hmm. And I was dreaming about building this city and about teaching and education. But now I think no future for us here.
Even as we continued talking with her through her evacuation to Rafah, she kept saying that, I think at some point her husband had to start making plans kind of for her, because she was just understandably unwilling to accept that she would have to have her baby in these conditions.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we are going to continue hearing about this Reveal podcast report about Lubna, a woman from Palestine who was pregnant and needed to deliver her child while the war there is raging.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm glad you're with us. Our guests today are Salman Ahad Khan and Gabrielle Berbe. They are journalists who have reported a story about pregnancies in Gaza while the war that Israel is raging against Gaza and against Palestine is taking place, and the effect on the healthcare system, but in particular on pregnant mothers. I want to start this part of the conversation talking more broadly about the devastation to the healthcare system in Gaza since the war started. The hospitals, healthcare infrastructure, they're all taking a real beating. I want to talk about the destruction of Al-Shifa Hospital in particular. Salman, can you tell us about that and what that means to healthcare in that area?
Yeah, so I think just in the broad context of things, I think within the first 6 days of the war, Israel had dropped almost 6,000 bombs on Gaza, and those killed almost 1,400 people there. And we spoke to an OBGYN for our story who was working at Al-Shifa Hospital at the time. And he told us within the first 3 to 4 days, the hospital had basically run out of all supplies. The doctors were were running low on almost everything, and they could barely cope with the huge numbers of patients that were coming in. I think they were getting 200-300 critical cases a day. And so he was telling us about what it was like for us at Al-Shifa at the beginning of the war, when mm-hmm. those first bombs were dropped. And it had already become so hard that the doctors were talking to each other and were asking, we don't know how we'll survive for 1 month. We don't even know what's going to happen, because we just don't have the supplies. And Israel had this policy. I think they announced it very early on that they're just going to do a total siege, a total blockade on supplies entering Gaza. And so that became a really difficult situation for doctors on the ground there, where they basically had to categorize every single case that was coming in as a hopeful case or a hopeless case, because their supplies were so limited, they mm-hmm. had to maximize the use of the supplies. And so they unfortunately would have to often talk to patients and tell them, and to patients' families and tell them, unfortunately, we know we can save someone else's life, and your case is just a bit too difficult right now to deal with.
Wow.
And we don't know if the supplies will be used as effectively as they might be on someone else. I think he even said anybody coming in over the age of 60 was essentially always effectively considered a hopeless case. And they basically would try to prioritize people who are younger. And wow. this was at the very first few weeks of the war. I think very quickly, Al-Shifa had become became a major talking point around this war, because Israel, I think, launched its first military raid on Al-Shifa in November, and they had made these outlandish claims that there were tunnels inside the hospital, that it was being used as a command center and a base for Hamas, that underneath there was basically the headquarters of Hamas militants hiding underneath the hospital. And that was the main reason that they had given to justify their raid. And when those reasons were later investigated in a Washington Post investigation and among other independent investigations, those claims have not held up as much. Those claims had not held up. But what did actually happen was that their raid essentially destroyed whatever facilities a lot of the facilities that the hospital did have at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of, I think Gabby can say a bit more about this, but I think you might have heard this new story of 31 babies who were in the, Gabby, can you clarify on that,
yeah.
on that point?
Yeah, go ahead, Gabby.
Yeah, so at least for, you know, with the state of like, the maternity wards and kind of prenatal wards, 31 premature babies were evacuated from Al-Shifa because they did not have fuel to power those incubators. So those babies were evacuated to Nasser Hospital. So, you know, this was already in mid-November. I think that was almost November 14th is when that was announced. So by this point, the hospital was already severely limited in what it could provide.
Yeah, and it was basically not functioning. Like most of the patients had been evacuated at that point, and since the Israeli army had been focusing in its invasion on the north of Gaza, but I think over the next month or so, slowly the capability started coming back alive. Doctors started coming back, and they were trying to resuscitate whatever facilities they had in the hospital. And then as we were wrapping up the story, the Israeli army launched another raid on Al-Shifa Hospital. And this time they actually went on a 2-week siege, and there was almost, and we started hearing all these news reports that were coming out of horrors and pictures that had started coming out from this latest siege. But we didn't know the extent of the destruction until the army finally evacuated the hospital, and mm-hmm. they called it a successful operation and that no civilians were harmed. But when the images started coming in, it became pretty clear that it was a massacre.
Yeah. So let's talk about the loss of that hospital and what it means in mm-hmm. that region. How critical was that hospital and the care that was available there to just the overall access to healthcare in the region?
Yeah, I mean, it was Gaza's largest hospital. From our understanding, it was responsible for almost 30% of all medical capacity throughout the Strip.
Wow.
I'm trying to think of what the Michigan equivalent of this would be, but it was a massive loss because it's not only Al Shifa Hospital, right? Like a lot of hospitals across Gaza, I think there are very few that are actually functioning right now. And the collapse of the destruction of Al Shifa is emblematic of a broader destruction of the healthcare system throughout Gaza.
Right. Gabrielle, according to the United Nations, there are also other kinds of effects on pregnant women from this collapse of the healthcare system. So, for instance, there are around 15,000 pregnant women in Gaza who are at risk of suffering from the famine that is unfolding because of the war. And 95% of pregnant and breastfeeding women are not getting adequate food or nutrition. This idea of the kind of ripple effects, I think, of the collapse of the healthcare system, thinking about what that does to women who are about to give birth and to their babies, again, is something that there hasn't been a lot of focus on, but it's something you guys saw up close.
Yeah, I'll start with kind of what's happening in Gaza, and I'll let Salman kind of take the broader context of the research there. But mm-hmm. in Gaza, the most recent report from a few days ago coming out of a maternity hospital was a Jezebel piece that was where they interviewed one of the doctors at the maternity hospital. And the report that came out of that hospital is the Emirati Maternity Hospital in Rafah, where I believe 1.5 million Gazans are displaced. The doctor there reported that they are seeing an increase in preterm babies, miscarriages, babies with congenital diseases, more birth complications, and more sick pregnant women. And that is due to the fact that right now they're much more so even than when we spoke to Lubna, there is famine that Gazans right now are living through. There's no, pregnant women are not getting enough food. They're not even getting enough water. So the result of that is what doctors are seeing is that that famine is affecting pregnant women and the babies that they are delivering and the health of both of them.
Yeah. Yeah. Salman, go ahead.
Yeah. And I think at the same time, since we were following Lubna's story, she did give birth in January. But we wanted to, as Gabby was talking about, really find out what were the long-term impacts of the famine that are going on. So our producer, Neroli Price, actually found a Dutch researcher, Dr. Tessa Roseboom, who had been basically her research had focused on exactly this question, which is what happens to the babies who were born during a famine or were conceived during a famine. And she her research focused on a period of famine during World War II called the Dutch Hunger Winter. And it was a period that had several similarities to what's happening in Gaza today, and offer some lessons that we could learn from too. The Dutch Hunger Winter was basically a period in World War II where German forces had blockaded food from entering the Netherlands, and Dr. Roseboom studied the effects of that famine on the children who were born during that famine or were conceived there. She told us that the lack of nutrients that they got in utero left lasting marks on their organs and tissues that were forming at the time. They basically it physiologically altered the organs that were developing, and the babies who were conceived during the famine and whose mothers were undernourished, while their brains were being built, their brains were smaller. When those people became adults, their brains became wired in a different way. They were more susceptible to stress and addiction because their bodies were just getting ready for a period of war. and a period of famine. So one example she gave us that really stuck with me was that she says their metabolisms were actually getting ready for a world with less food. Wow. But when the famine had ended and those babies grew into adults and food became available again, their bodies just weren't ready for the amount of food that was out there. And that ended up leading to them becoming susceptible to all kinds of diseases. So diabetes, cardiovascular disease, certain types of cancer, even their mental health was more at risk. And so they were more susceptible to, as I said, stress and addiction, but also depression in particular and schizophrenia.
Yeah.
But I think the important difference to note between the Dutch famine and Dr. Rosenbaum's research and the famine in Gaza today is that during the Dutch famine, their medical system was still fully intact, so they could still provide some care for patients. In Gaza, as we talked about, the medical system has been destroyed. And so we can't really imagine what the consequences for this might be for Gaza's generations to come.
Yeah. So I wonder, Gabrielle, about women like Lubna, who were, when you met her, considering leaving. Because of these conditions, she thought she probably had to. She thought she probably could. How common is that, do you think, among women who faced these problems? 15,000 pregnant women in Gaza at risk of being victims of the famine. How many of them would even be able to contemplate leaving to save their own lives, but also to preserve the lives of the children they were about to give birth to?
So right now, you know, the only like sure, I feel like maybe this is not the right way to say this, but the only like sure way to probably get out is that you have to be a citizen of another country. But even still, there are still citizens of other countries that are stuck in Gaza. But, you know, if you are not a citizen of another country, right now, your hands are tied in terms of just being able to get out through any official means. So Lubna got out with the help of cousins in Egypt, mm-hmm. but a lot of people are getting out through paying middlemen and Egyptian travel agencies to wow. basically pay between $4,000 to $10,000 per person to the Egyptian government to get out. So really, you have to have means to get out. Right now, what you're seeing are scores of GoFundMe pages of people trying to raise money to get their family members out. I was literally just looking at one before we got on the call, and someone was asking for $50,000 to get three of his sisters out of Gaza. So you can only imagine how expensive
yes.
it is to get people out right now.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. We're going to take another quick break. And when we come back, we are going to hear the conclusion of the story of Lubna and her sister Wafa, who decided they had to leave Gaza because of the war that Israel is waging against it. They had to leave because Lubna was pregnant and was going to deliver a child. Stay where you are. We'll be right back with more Created Equal. You're listening to Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and thanks for joining us. We're talking with Saman Ahad Khan and with Gabrielle Berbe. They are journalists who have done a story for the podcast Reveal about a woman in Gaza who was pregnant and when the war started decided that she needed to leave to save her own life, but also to save the life of her child. We're also talking about the devastation that the healthcare system in Gaza has suffered during Israel's war against it. So, guys, Wafa was able to leave Gaza for Canada because she had Canadian citizenship. What did that mean for Lubna, her sister who was pregnant?
So when Wafaa left Gaza, she could not take Lubna with her. So she was trying to do everything she can to pressure the Canadian government, along with the thousands of other Gazan Canadians, asking the Canadian government to get their family members out of Gaza. By the end of December, Canada had announced an evacuation program that they would launch. Mm-hmm. And they said that they would evacuate the family members of Canadian citizens out of Gaza. So that seemed in that moment like maybe Lubna would be able to get out right before her due date. Yeah. At that point, she was going to be due in a couple weeks. But the problem right away was that the program very quickly came with all of these red tape, all of this red tape. Mm-hmm. First, the program would not even launch until January 9th. You know, that was over about 20 days away at that point, and it was going to be past Lubna's due date. And Wafaa didn't even know if Lubna would be alive then. And then the program also had a list of requirements that Palestinians, that Gazans would have to provide in order to apply. So they would have to provide documentation like biometric data, a record of all of the passports they've held, every scar they have on their body, employment history since the age of 16, which was just a completely unrealistic bar for so many Gazans to meet because so many of them had evacuated their homes with just a few minutes warning, in Lubna's case, in the middle of the night. So right away, this program had all of this red tape.
Yeah.
And Wafaa, when we spoke with her, was not optimistic that Lubna was going to be able to get out through this program. And she was right. So, you know, it's now April, but we spoke to we reached out to the Canadian government for comment at the end of March for the status of the program. And by the end of March, this is over three months after the program launched, they had not been able to evacuate anyone out of Gaza, despite the fact that they had launched this program. So they had 986 applications, and no one had been able to get out of Gaza through that program.
Wow.
So the Canadian government cited problems with local officials, but it's just been a complete failure of an evacuation program.
I think
go ahead, Salman.
It was also jarring for us to see the differences in the way that the Canadian government had treated Palestinian Canadians versus the way they had treated Ukrainians. A lot of family members began pointing out that when the war in Ukraine started, Ukrainians didn't even have to be related to Canadian citizens to qualify. There was no cap on how many people could apply, and Ukrainians coming to Canada were even offered financial support. And so Palestinians in Canada were often asking, why can't we have the same thing for our families that the Ukrainians got? I think it was just a very jarring experience for us to see the disparity in the way the two groups of refugees were
I want to talk about that disparity and why it exists and what can be done to sort of loosen that up. What is the reason that Palestinian refugees are treated differently from people from other countries?
So when we asked the Canadian government about these disparities, they cited, they said that all of the programs are run differently and it's so dependent on the conflict on the ground. And that was as much as they said. You know, when it came to things like, you know, they did provide an answer to why Ukrainians were offered financial support. They said that Ukrainians were offered financial support because they didn't have to be related to Canadian citizens to apply. So presumably Palestinians coming to Canada had family in Canada that could help them. But that was like the only point where I was like, okay, I guess that's an answer. That's a direct answer to one of our questions.
Right.
But otherwise it was just citing, different situations on the ground, that the conflict was just more difficult to navigate. But I think what's worth noting is that it was something that they said they were going to do, but then they didn't do even at all. I mean, like, we're talking about a discrepancy in what you know, in these program requirements. But it's like, at the end of the day, it doesn't even matter because no one's been able to actually get out through the program at all anyway. Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's also the point that was really infuriating a lot of the Palestinians that we were talking to, mm-hmm. was their tax dollars had funded Ukrainians coming in who weren't even related. And then the Canadian government's explanation was, because Palestinians have family members in Canada, they will not get the support from the government that the Ukrainians got.
Right.
And despite all of that, they still did not evacuate the people. And I think the other important thing to note is that this was like one of the, especially when we were talking to Wafa through this process, mm-hmm. this was also one of the few moments where Wafa, like where people in Canada, like Palestinians in Canada, were given a bit of hope that they could actually get their family members out in time. And a lot of, like, I think the Canadian government was one of the first Western governments to launch a program like this. And that was, like, we were talking to other sources as well, and that was a moment of hope for a lot of them.
Yeah.
And just to see that hope be stretched out over months and months and months, and then eventually have the same outcome, was just devastating.
Yeah.
And I think it's worth noting, I just want to make clear that, you know, the people we talk to, like Wafa and the people we talk to in Canada, are saying, of course, we should do everything we can to bring everyone who is going through crisis. So they're not saying Ukrainians shouldn't get this treatment. They're just saying, why is there not the same treatment being offered to Palestinians as well? Hmm. I think it's also worth noting that the United States has not launched any evacuation program at all. So, there's a difference in how Canada and the U.S. are responding to the crisis as well.
Yeah. So Lubna does eventually evacuate to Egypt after her family's names appear on a Facebook list. We've got a quick clip.
It was maybe 10 p.m. and we opened the Facebook waiting for the list. So when we find our name, we were like screaming, shouting, and hugging each other and crying, you know, because halas, we will be out of this war, out of this death, you know.
How is she now?
She feels very lucky to be there. At the same time, when we spoke to her after her delivery, she just kept telling us that she is not okay and that they are not okay. Mm-hmm. They are in Egypt where they are not able to work. They are all, as you know, she said, dealing with the emotional, psychological toll that being in Gaza took on them. She's trying to make sure that her two teenage daughters will be okay after this. Her eldest daughter, Tia, who's 18, she said, is having horrible nightmares every single night, has to sleep with Lubna in the bed.
Wow.
So in addition to dealing with a newborn, she's also dealing with trying to support her family through what they've been through and trying to figure out how they're going to make money. So it's a very bleak situation. They've applied for residency in Australia and have been denied, and they are still waiting for Canada to respond to their application to at least evacuate them from Egypt to Canada.
My last question is about people who are still in Gaza, pregnant mothers. If the war were to end tomorrow, I think everyone anticipates that at some point it will end. The level of devastation there is so great. I wonder what happens to them in the future. As I said, Lubna's potential future in Canada seems like a good opportunity. What happens to everybody else who will continue to need access to this kind of care?
That's a tough question. Mm-hmm. Because I think that's something that'll be hard to see unfold over the next few years, because someone we had talked to said that the message was very clear for them, that Gaza was not made to be an inhabitable place anymore.
Yeah.
And anybody who could leave was trying to leave. And one of the big reasons for that is that the utter destruction of the healthcare system we've talked about. I mean, I personally can't even imagine what it must be like to just see all, like basically every medical facility that you're used to. So all your cancer hospitals, your maternity wards, all we were talking to someone whose aunt was undergoing dialysis treatments, and in the first few weeks of the war, she passed away because she just wasn't able to get those treatments. Mm. And from what we understand, like those figures are not necessarily being included in the larger figures of the toll of this of Israel's war. And I think that's something that I guess the entire international community will have to reckon with and do their best to support the rebuilding of Gaza however they can.
Can it be rebuilt? Is that even possible?
I mean, again, I think we're probably I don't think it's a question of whether it can be rebuilt or not, but whether it's allowed to be rebuilt. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of it has to do with, especially right now, as we're seeing, the U.S. government has a big role to play in this. The Israeli government has a big role to play in this.
Yes.
And I think the international community has an equally big role to play to pressure both of these governments to allow the rebuilding of Gaza. And I think, again, the thing that keeps surprising me, that kept surprising me about this story was, no matter, even despite this intense blockade over the past 16, 17 years, Palestinians in Gaza were able to build so much. They had fantastic universities. I think they had my understanding is they had one of the highest literacy rates around the world, just because for Gazans, education was such a high priority. For people like Lubna, education was such a high priority. And that was one of the reasons she didn't want to leave Gaza before this, was she wanted to stay in Gaza and help build a prosperous future for all of Gaza.
Wow.
And I think it's heartbreaking to see all the people who've been forced to evacuate and have basically been forcibly displaced from their homes. And a lot of them want to go back. But it's just...
Right. It's a question of go back to what, right?
And yeah, if they'll be allowed. I mean, there's a question of you have to go cross a border to get back into Gaza. Will those people be allowed to cross that border again? Mm-hmm. That's... There's so many...
And I think there are historical parallels with the Nakba, where so many families were forcibly displaced and they thought that they would be able to go back, and they were never able to go back. And that's why Palestinians are one of the largest refugee populations around the world.
Yeah. Okay. Salman Ahad Khan and Gabrielle Berbe, it was really great to have you here on Created Equal, and really wonderful to hear your story about Lubna and Wafa. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, that was a really important episode.
Yeah, I think it was. And I think the importance is the focus on the people of Gaza and what's happening to them. This was a really compelling story from Reveal. But in a larger sense, it trains the camera on the people who are having to figure out their lives and their health and well-being while a war unfolds around them.
I think also people think about the impact of the war being the violence that ensues during a war and who is the victim of that violence, which is one way to think about it, but also...
That's an important way to think about it.
I think what this story really elevates is kind of the secondary impacts of that, right? When you don't have a healthcare facility, what then can you rely on when you're in need, right? Yeah. When you're sick or when you're ill or when you're hurt or when you're pregnant.
Yeah, the consequences of violence, both short-term and long-term. You've got to go to this level of storytelling to be able to see that this person who's just trying to live her life can't do it because of the war. That's it for Created Equal. You can listen to recent episodes at WDET.org and make sure to subscribe to our podcast where you can leave us a rating or a review. Created Equal is produced by Carrie Jr. II and David Lines. The audio editing is by Connor Anderson and the music is by Sam Bovian. Created Equal is a production of WDET, a listener-supported service of Wayne State University.